This is the story of an idea, a powerful and troubling idea, which is born in a Victorian quest for a better society, but reaches a horrifying climax in the death camps of Nazi Germany. This is the story of eugenics, its dark history, and its troubling present.
You have good genes, you know that, right? You have good genes. A lot of it's about the genes, isn't it? Don't you believe? The racehorse theory, you think we're so different? You have good genes in Minnesota.
The word eugenics comes from the Greek, meaning well-born or of good stock. But a modern translation might well be good genes. That clip was President Trump speaking at a campaign rally in Minnesota in September 2020. At the time, mainstream American news outlets reacted to Trump's speech with alarm. CNN worried about its dark subtext. Rolling Stone asserted that Trump explicitly embraced eugenics. And Business Insider noted that the speech prompted comparisons to the Nazi obsession with the master race. Now, Trump's unscripted, meandering speeches often prompted shocked gasps from a clickbaity media. So were they overreacting? Well, buried in those few sentences, there are three ideas that would have got the eugenicists of the early 20th century enthusiastically nodding in agreement. The first is that your biological inheritance, your genes, determine your life outcomes. Are you successful, smart, rich? According to this view, success has little to do with inherited wealth or privilege. It's just good genes. And what about the racehorse theory? Well, if you want to breed the next generation of racehorses, what do? You pick a fast, muscly mare and a fast, muscly stud, and you get them to breed. As Trump says, we're not all that different. If then we can breed faster horses or woollier sheep or smarter dogs, why not breed better humans? But the third idea buried in there is the most incendiary. That speech was given in Minnesota, a state with significant Scandinavian ancestry. One key strain of 20th century eugenic thinking is the superiority of Northwestern European ancestry, sometimes called Nordic or Aryan.
You know, I'm proud to have that German blood. There's no question about it. Great stuff.
What happens when prejudices and politics are elevated to the status of scientific truth? I'm Adam Rutherford. I'm a geneticist. Genetics is about sex and inheritance in families, in people, and in populations. It's part of what makes us who we are, our hair and our eyes, our abilities and our potential. Those are old preoccupations of humankind. But genetics itself is fairly new and is one of the most exciting and important areas of science today. But it emerged as a scientific discipline out of eugenics. So this is my story too. And here is where this tale begins. The year is 1864 and we're in Aberdeen. A man stands stiffly on a busy street corner, a concentrated look on his grizzled face, hands thrust deep into his pockets. He's a distinguished Victorian gentleman, long Chesterfield overcoat, a silk top hat, and bushy mutton chop sideburns. A woman walks past. He looks her up and down and then fumbles under his long coat. He looks around. What lady is next? This man is not a pervert, but he is doing something unusual. In his pocket, he's wearing a single leather glove with short needles on each of the first three fingers. With each woman who passes, this man is pricking a piece of paper, scoring them in one of three categories of his own design. Attractive, indifferent, or repellent. Meet Francis Galton, polymath, travel writer, statistician, and above all, obsessive data collector. We're in Aberdeen, but it could be London or Bristol or Derby or Hull, because Galton is ranking women to create a beauty map of the British Isles.
When people ask me what Galton was like, I say he's both a Victorian gentleman and he's really quirky.
This is Joe Kane, Professor of History and Philosophy of Biology at University College London.
He's interested in all kinds of things, and he's the kind of fellow who would pick up a casual conversation in a discussion and run with it. And then about a week later, you'd hear back and he'd say, I thought about this quite a lot, and here's what I've done with it. So he's quirky, he's smart, he's charming to some people at least, and he's interested in just about everything.
And especially collecting data.
In every situation, he wants to quantify stuff. He goes to a dinner party and you get the sense that he's just counting everything around. He lives in those numbers. He's not the first, but he is really prominently obsessive about it.
Galton's key phrase, his maxim, his mantra was, whenever you can, count. Galton's beauty map was just one of his many projects where he tried to quantify things that hadn't been studied in that way, sometimes vague or subjective things.
So, for instance, in 1884, he had an idea for an attraction gauge.
This is Dan Meyer, a writer for film and television, who became fascinated by Galton's strange mind.
So he noticed that when people were sitting around at a dinner party, if you were interested in the person sitting next to you, you would lean in to talk to them. So you would literally be inclined towards them. And if you weren't interested, you wouldn't lean in, you'd lean away and you'd lean to talk to the person on the other side. So he thought then it's just a short step to make attraction measurable by placing pressure pads under the chairs of people around a dinner party. And then the more pressure you put on the arm of your chair, the more inclined you were, the higher the reading would be. So this was a way of scaling attraction. And similarly, he observed that people at a race course, in the grandstand of a race course, as the horses ran by, their faces would flush with excitement, so that he could somehow correlate the sort of change in colour, the wave of pinkness going across the grandstand, with a change in excitement levels of a crowd as they watched races. So he was always looking and thinking about these things. Clearly, wherever he was going, he was noticing human emotion, and then trying to sort of hammer it down and make it measurable.
And there were plenty more similarly whimsical ideas. Galton's invention of a vented hat to keep your head cool whilst thinking hard, and an algorithm for making the perfect cup of tea. But amidst his more trivial stuff, there are a host of genuinely brilliant inventions which have an incomparable legacy even today. Galton was the first person to plot a weather map, the sort you see on the forecast every single day. His work on fingerprints resulted in their use for criminal forensics. And his use of mathematical methods like correlation and regression are the nuts and bolts of statistics. So who is this weird genius? Francis Galton is the son of a rich family of Midlands Quakers, Quaker gunsmiths actually, and celebrated author of Travel Guide to the Heart of Africa. He's also the half-cousin of the greatest celebrity genius of the Victorian men of science, the father of evolution himself.
A lot of people make a big deal out of Galton's connection to Charles Darwin, and Galton was the first one to make a big deal out of it. And he's kind of the person who stands behind a celebrity to say, yeah, I'm with them. Galton would regularly remind people that he was related to Charles Darwin. He would regularly produce family trees that would connect him to Darwin. Because Darwin is the man of genius, and you know, it's not guilt by association, it's pride by association.
Pride and also inspiration. His most influential ideas, the ideas for which he is now almost exclusively known, were initially inspired by reading Darwin's The Origin of Species in 1859. The mechanism by which evolution moves along is natural selection. But Darwin also wrote about artificial selection, the kind that farmers and breeders had been using for thousands of years, carefully selecting pigeons and breeding them to enhance their homing capabilities, or sheep to produce a better quality of wool, or racehorses to get the fastest stallions. It made Galton wonder, why not do the same for the ladies and gentlemen of Britain? Why not selectively breed the best and brightest in Victorian society? He set about studying the great men, and it was only men, of Europe in his 1869 book, Hereditary Genius, to account for how eminence flows through lineages, and conversely, how undesirable traits are also inherited. But what Galton did is apply statistics to demonstrate that their greatness was biological nature, not nurture. Reading the book today, there's something critical that he misses. Here's Professor Philippa Levine from the University of Texas at Austin.
He cannot see in that book the ways in which what you're doing is simply replicating advantage and making sure that advantage doesn't trickle out, but stays within a certain number of people. And so, you know, he says, oh, well, look at this genius, you know, obviously runs down generations of, as you say, of men, from grandpa to dad to son. And it never occurs to him that, you know, perhaps if you gave other people the same privileged education and judged them by the same, you know, in that way, you might actually find genius, if such a thing exists, elsewhere.
For Galton, whether you're a genius or a fool, rich or poor, a success or a failure, it's all just biology. Nature versus nurture, which, in case you're wondering, is a phrase invented by Galton himself. So if you want to improve people, you have to control nature. That's why in 1883, he's casting around for a new term. And in a footnote, he ventures,
"We greatly want a brief word to express the science of improving stock."
Combining the Greek words for well and born, he comes up with eugenics, a scientific movement to give
the more suitable races or strains of blood a better chance of prevailing over the less suitable.
What Galton does is he supercharges the eugenics agenda by making it feel like it's science. And he also inspired other people to do the same thing. So eugenics existed long before British universities were around. Eugenics existed in lots of other places. It's just that the flavor that they put on it was science. And what they hoped for was that science would give it legitimacy and validity that wasn't otherwise there.
Galton introduces new ways of studying and thinking about how traits are passed down through the generations. He's obsessed with somewhat vague intellectual qualities like genius or feeble-mindedness, and he attempts to map them on family trees. This is the technique that we still use today to understand heredity in genetics and medicine, though we do tend to be a little bit more scientifically precise. For Galton, it's all about an assessment of some vague sense of a person's quality. Here's Philippa Levine.
So Galton's particular contribution, I think, in addition obviously to the term eugenics, is this principle of bringing together the quantification on the one hand and the dream of improving the human race on the other. And it's when you put those two together that you get the explosion, I think, of eugenics.
Once it was out in the world, Victorian Britain proved fertile soil for this new science of improving human stock. Britain was at the peak of its might on the international stage, an imperial superpower with a thriving middle class. But a century of breakneck industrialisation and economic growth had nurtured a massive population of urban poor living in desperate conditions, and the hand-wringing middle classes were concerned.
There are extraordinary levels of poverty, and this starts being brought to national attention really for the first time.
Professor Angelique Richardson from Exeter University.
You have depictions of large families crowded into small rooms, single rooms. You've got leaking ceilings, you've got predatory landlords, and this is starting to be represented now in the periodical press. It's coming to national attention. So you have two columns in the Daily News, which Dickens had founded some years earlier, and those are called Homes of the London Poor and Evenings with the Poor. And it's quite prurient, really. It's almost a Victorian version of poverty porn. You know, it's a sort of giving people access to the poor at the same time as they were being othered.
Charitable societies were emerging to address the social problems arising from poverty. The Moral Education League, the Society for the Study of Inebriety, the National Association for the Care and Protection of the Feeble-Minded. It's in this tradition that the Eugenics Education Society was founded in 1907 by the formidable Sybil Gotto, a tireless organiser and campaigner who brought together an impressive group of middle-class professionals, lawyers, doctors, scientists, writers, more than three-quarters of whom were eminent enough to be included in the Dictionary of National Biography, A friend of hers breathlessly wrote that
Mrs. Gotto was the moving spirit which inspired them all. The idea of educating the public on such broad and varied lines filled all with what might be called a religious zeal. The success of the movement, without any thought of self, dominated all those who joined.
Their mission was grand, to instill eugenic ideas into the conscience of civilization like a new religion. This was a deeply moral crusade, in the interest not of themselves, but of nation and empire. But what use is eugenics for addressing what was the central problem of the age, which was poverty? Well, for Galton and his well-to-do disciples, the poorest and most destitute members of society were regarded as a different breed of human, biologically distinct.
The Eugenics Education Society thought that poverty was the result not of society but biology. They thought it was down to inherited defect, and therefore the only way to address it was through biology, by changing the breeding patterns of the nation.
Poverty was in the genes. That meant that better housing or improved education or public health, none of those things could ever make much of a difference. The only way to reduce poverty was to stop poor people having babies. Their first official act as a society in 1908 was to protest against the closure of homes for chronic inebriate women in London. By closing these refuges, the council was effectively forcing poor, vulnerable women onto the streets. But the protesting members of the Eugenics Education Society were not primarily concerned for the welfare of these women. They were worried that by being set adrift in London, they would take up with men and have litters of babies. A result, the members complained, which would be inevitably detrimental to the race. Eugenic ideas weren't just thriving in the societies and salons of the intelligentsia. They were catching on in popular culture too. In particular, a group of novelists were writing stories with eugenic ideas at their core, capturing the spirit of the nation's new women. Here's Angelique Richardson.
The term new woman was coined in 1893, and there were about 100 novels by or about the new woman, and they were really concerned with new expressions of femininity, the bicycling, independent woman, and ways in which she pushed against conventional ideas. Someone like Sarah Grand is an advocate of eugenic ideas. There's one novel called Galia, published in 1895, which puts forward the idea that instead of making people better, instead of curing people of illnesses, we should make better people.
And the way to make better people is by having babies with better partners, picking someone who meets a list of eugenic criteria. You could even get eugenics Valentine's cards. Popular novelists like Sarah Grand wanted women to be empowered with choice over who they have children with.
They developed the idea of eugenic feminism, whereby women should be able to make reproductive choices about who they marry based on fitness. This is why they see the novel as such a valuable instrument to eugenics, because it's centrally engaged with the love plot, and that's what they want to rewrite. They want to replace passion with reason.
Galton himself had realised that to alter the breeding patterns of a nation, you needed to infiltrate the way people think about romance and marriage. You needed to influence who they breed with and how many babies they have. In 1907, Galton received a letter from his friend and protégé, Carl Pearson, brimming with delight.
You would be amused to hear how general is now the use of your word, eugenics. I hear most respectable middle-class matrons saying, if the children are weakly, ah, that was not a eugenic marriage.
Within a couple of decades, the term eugenics has erupted from the pages of a dry academic text and into the national consciousness. A brief footnote had mutated into a popular movement to be pursued, in Galton's own words, as a
jihad, a holy war against customs and prejudices that impair the physical and moral qualities of our race.
Mm.
1912. We're at the Imperial Institute in South Kensington, a sunny July morning. The setting is regal, the 87-metre-high Queen's Tower, testament to the dominance of the British Empire. This is the stage for the first International Eugenics Congress. The great and the good are all here. There's the inventor, Alexander Graham Bell, and the Dean of St Paul's, the Reverend W.R. Inger, mingling with the former Prime Minister, Arthur Balfour, who would give the conference banquet speech, tickets 7 shillings and 6 pence. There's also the future Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, then merely First Lord of the Admiralty. But it's Major Leonard Darwin, son of Charles, who opens the meeting with his presidential address.
We must hope that the 20th century will be known in the future as the century when the eugenics ideal was accepted as part of the creed of civilization.
The whole event was organised by the formidable founder and moving spirit of the Eugenics Education Society, Sybil Gotto. Francis Galton, the Society's honorary president, had passed away the previous year, but members of the Society were proudly identifiable by their button badges featuring a picture of Galton's head. There are delegates from Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, and America. There's talks about eugenics in marriage, in medicine, about alcoholism, insanity, and animal breeding. Remember the racehorse theory? The conference is the nascent eugenics movement's nexus, a moment where the social, political, cultural, and scientific apostles gather, pat each other on the back, and go forth to spread the international gospel. By 1912, the eugenics movement is everywhere, politically respectable and internationally influential. For its champions, it was the application of cutting-edge science to urgent moral and social issues. Eugenics was seen as a deeply modern cause. Here's Philippa Levine.
In the 19th century, to be modern was to be scientific. To be modern was to be rational in these scientific and technological ways. And so eugenics is profoundly, I think, a statement of, a celebration of the idea that modernity will be progress, will improve the lot of the human race, that we won't make the mistakes that have been made in the past, that we won't have our civilization decay in the way that Rome did and others did. Eugenics is central and speaks to that sense that this is the way forward, that this is going to save the human race.
But amidst the grand proclamations of scientists and politicians, amidst their bracing visions of breeding our way to a healthier, wealthier society, the darker, more ruthless and oppressive implications of these ideas were becoming clear. Talks at the conference were also about the elimination of defectives, about the inferiority of physical and mental capabilities of the lower classes, and of Rassenhygiene, race hygiene, the German idea that just like individuals are protected from disease by personal hygiene, the purity of the Nordic race should also be protected from infection. In the years leading up to the 1912 conference, Churchill had been pushing for the forced sterilisation of those deemed undesirable. In a letter to Prime Minister Asquith, he wrote,
"The unnatural and increasingly rapid growth of the feeble-minded and insane classes constitutes a national and race danger which it is impossible to exaggerate."
Churchill wrote early drafts of the Mental Deficiency Act, which became law in 1913. It allowed for the involuntary institutionalisation of those deemed idiots, imbeciles, or feeble-minded. But it didn't include enforced sterilisation. Victorian Britain was the nursery of the eugenic movement, but Britain never codified explicitly eugenic ideas into law. It never embarked on a programme of sterilising certain groups against their will in the way that many, many other countries around the world would go on to do. Churchill's attempts to get involuntary sterilisation of the feeble-minded into law was blocked. Opposition came from cultural figureheads such as G.K. Chesterton, who felt eugenics was abhorrent, Political figures, notably the MP Josiah Wedgwood of the Pottery Dynasty, fought fiercely against what he regarded as an unproven science and who recoiled in horror at the idea of breeding people like cattle. That didn't mean that the idea had been vanquished. Arguments for eugenics persisted. In the 1930s, the scientist and writer Julian Huxley, brother of Aldous, made a eugenic education film expressing essentially the same ideas as Churchill, over footage of young people with intellectual disabilities smiling at the camera. He narrates,
"Once they have been born, defectives are happier and more useful in these institutions than when at large. But it would have been better by far, for them and for the rest of the community, if they had never been born."
So, eugenics emerges as an idea in Victorian Britain. It was based on science that we now reject, but it had enough scientific credibility to convince many that it was the answer to the problems within Victorian society. Galton and others had articulated an idea which would remain a powerful force right up to today. Ultimately, it's about who is valued and who is not. That is an idea which is not limited to Victorian history, but is very much part of our present. Here's Professor Joe Kane.
Eugenics thinking is in every country, in every culture, at every time. I mean, when my grandmother told me, don't go out with someone because their uncle is an alcoholic and that runs in families, that's eugenics. And my grandmother didn't need science to worry about that particular thing. Or when somebody told me, you can't date that person because they're not in your race. It's an extraordinary thing to say. And nowadays, we don't need the label of eugenics to say that's bad thinking. That's wrong thinking. But I don't just want to slap a label on it and then feel like we've actually dealt with the problem in society. What I'd like to do is deal with the problem in society. Because Lord knows, putting labels on things doesn't solve things in the long run. They just let them fester so they come back again later, and sometimes stronger.
In the next episode of Bad Blood, we travel across the Atlantic to progressive-era USA. The Jazz Age, where American aristocrats enthusiastically latch onto eugenics amidst waves of immigration, economic upheaval, and the rise of the Ku Klux Klan.